This episode is brought to you by Quince. Folks, I'm not big on trends, but I am big on clothes that feel good and last. That's why I keep going back to Quince. Their lightweight layers and high-quality staples have become my everyday essentials. Quince has all the things you actually want to wear this summer, like organic cotton silk polos, European linen beach shorts, and comfortable pants that work for everything from backyard hangs to nice dinners. And the best part? Everything with Quince is half the cost of similar brands. By working directly with top artisans and cutting out the middlemen, Quince gives you luxury pieces without the markups. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. This is a true story. I have a coworker who is nice enough to sometimes watch the Curbsiders videos, and she specifically pointed out, she's like, there was one time you were wearing this really nice sweater, and no one has ever commented on any clothing in any video I've ever been in. And she mentioned this 100% yak wool crew neck sweater that I got from Quince. And the thing looks great, really comfortable, shockingly affordable. And that's when I knew I had found a clothing company for me. So if this sounds appealing to you, stick to the staples that last with elevated essentials from Quince. Go to quince.com/curb for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/curb to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/curb.
Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're right.
This episode of the Curbsiders is brought to you in partnership with the American College of Physicians. ACP members can claim free CME and mock credit at www.acponline.org/curbsiders.
Welcome back to The Curbsiders, the internal medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. I'm Chris the Chew Man Chew, and I'm here with my co-hosts Dr. Matthew Watto and Dr. Paul Williams. Producers on this episode are Dr. Jasni Devgan, Dr. Justin Burke, and Beth Garbs-Garbatelli. This episode will cover the primary and secondary prevention of ASCVD, including common questions on the appropriate management of patients, LDL goals and follow-up, and when to step up or stop therapy. We're joined by our guest, Dr. Aaron Mikos, who is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Cardiology and Department of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins University. She also holds the title of Director of Women's Cardiovascular Health and the Associate Director of Preventive Cardiology at her institution. She has published over 280 manuscripts, including JACC and JAMA, and is the editorial board of Circulation. She is the co-investigator of the MESA and ERIC studies, and her specific research interests include cardiovascular disease in women, physical activity and nutrition, and the risk prediction models such as coronary calcium scoring and the use of biomarkers to assess this risk. And on with the show.
So, Aaron, the first thing we like to ask our guests is, can you give us one liner, describe yourself, and tell the audience something about yourself, a hobby outside of medicine?
Sure. So I'm a preventive cardiologist and a daughter, wife, and a mother of a soon-to-be 13-year-old. So I'm getting into a teenager in my house.
Yikes.
And my hobby is running, although I'm not very talented at it, but I'm trying to run a marathon in all 50 states. And so I finished 36 states so far, just 14 left to go.
Holy cow.
Holy cow. I'm very slow at them. So
that was going to be my question, because I saw you put it on Twitter about trying to do that. I was going to ask you how far you were getting. So
yeah.
Still my question. Okay.
Yeah. You're on the back nine-ish. Wow. Congratulations. That's a lot of marathons.
Thank you. Thank you. It combines my love of running with my love of travel and a way of seeing the country in a different way.
You don't run it in like a green man suit or something like that, do you? I know there's a lot of those. Are you a known character at marathons?
No.
That would just make it so much cooler. But
okay. That would make it so much cooler. But
does the pizza box guy still run? You know what I'm talking about? He like used to carry around like a pizza box. It was almost like a Statue of Liberty type thing, but it was like a pizza box. Apparently it weighed like 10 pounds and you carry it the whole marathon.
Yeah, there's always a banana in every race, the running banana.
All right.
I literally just ran the Las Vegas Rock and Roll Half Marathon on Sunday. So that was the tail end of my vacation before coming back. So I feel like I've pretty much caught up to you, except that was my first half marathon and I never want to do it again. But I feel like otherwise we're pretty close.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We're the same. Congratulations. Yeah,
yeah. Paul?
Sure. So we usually ask about a favorite book or book you feel other physicians should read. I think I'm going to broaden it a little bit for you and just ask Because I have too many book recommendations anyway. So just any kind of recent piece of pop culture that you've consumed, that you've enjoyed, that you can recommend so we can all decompress.
Yeah. So I haven't read the book, but I've already adopted the philosophy about the Marie Kondo approach of what sparks joy, because I'm actually moving to a new house. So I've had to like go through all my things of what sparks joy and that doesn't move into the new house. But I've been trying to do this with my personal professional life, to engage with people and activities that bring me meaning and value and declutter all the rest of my life that doesn't spark joy.
Oh, you're decluttering people as well. That's good.
Well, you know, there are some, you know, negative people that don't spark joy, but
sure, the haters. Yep. And do you thank them before you sort of get them out of your life? Is that part of the process?
And then
well?
Throw them in the trash.
It's called the mute button on Twitter. So.
So my question is, what is the best advice you ever received as a learner, or as a teacher, or in your career?
Yeah. So, you know, I like to run. So I always talk in running analogies about, you know, an academic career is a marathon and not a sprint. And so my personal mantra is the 2018 Boston Marathon winner, Des Linden. She has this phrase, you know, keep showing up. And so, you know, that's my academic philosophy. I keep showing up, you know, whenever my grants are not discussed or my papers rejected or, you know, every day I just keep showing up. So that's my advice.
We got to brag about this. This is we're recording this shortly after this was released, and this is going to come out in the new year. This episode, I believe, is going to come out in early January. We're recording this in late November, but you had a paper published in the New England Journal titled "Lipid Management for the Prevention of Atherosclerotic Cardiovascular Disease." You're the first author. It's fantastic. If you feel confused after this episode, just read that paper. It explains everything very well.
Thank you. Talk about keep showing up. I actually was working on that for almost like 5 years, different versions. And so I'm very happy to see it finally published.
Yeah, it does a really great job of just like bringing together the 2018 lipid guidelines, the 2019 cardiovascular disease prevention guidelines. It's just fantastic.
And to have the famous New England Journal figure next to the words that you've written has to be thrilling too. Like the one that sort of goes over the targets of lipid control. Just I can't imagine. It's got to be a thrill.
Yeah. So I think we should get, I know we have a lot of stuff to get into tonight. Did anybody want to give quick picks of the week? Paul, did you have something you wanted to give?
I always have something. It depends on whether or not you want it or not.
Okay. Let's do it. We can give brief ones.
Sure. Yeah. This will not be one of my endless movie descriptions. I'm going to recommend a book for a change. I'm going to recommend the book Shadowland by Peter Straub. It's a 1980 book. Peter Straub is a award-winning horror and suspense author. He's written with Stephen King a couple of books too. But it's basically a story that's about two kids who go to the same boarding school, who are brought together by the shared love of magic, and they go to one of the kids' uncle's house for a vacation, and things turn sinister and kind of hallucinatory. And it's a book that's very steeped in the mythology of fairy tales, and as well as the power of story itself. And so the whole thing it's a fascinating, engrossing read. So if you want something that's just a nice diversion, just in time to have missed Halloween, I'm going to recommend Shadowland by Peter Straub.
Sounds good. What about you, Chris?
I have a few picks of the week, too.
Ooh, Beth, you go first.
Oh, sure. So if you're in the mood to watch something, The Crown is really awesome. And the new season, this is going to kind of date the episode, but the new season came out in November. So you can catch up on the old seasons, but the new season with the new cast is really good so far. I haven't finished it, but yeah, really, it's kind of funny at points, and it gives you a little bit of a history lesson, although sometimes it's not always clear how much of it's fabricated, but it's just a fun kind of watch, and really well made. And then in terms of books, two that I haven't finished yet but I'm in the midst of reading are Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow, and it's about the predators in Hollywood and kind of going into the investigation of that. And it does kind of give you the story that you've heard before, but a lot more detail. So if you're interested in knowing more about that, I recommend it. And Trick Mirror, which is a collection of essays by Gia Tolentino, who's a New Yorker writer. And they're about sort of being in the modern era, and kind of hard to explain what the general theme is between them, besides that they sort of relate to technology and how we display ourselves on technology and current trends and stuff. So check it out.
You're doing a lot of reading for a medical student, Beth. I'm very impressed.
I've been trying to use less screens and more reading, and it has improved my like mood and my concentration. I feel like makes me more focused. I like lock my phone up now during the day when I'm studying, and it's my productivity has gotten so much better. It's kind of alarming.
Yeah. All right.
Finally, maybe you can accomplish something here in your second year of medical school.
Yeah.
Chris, should we move into it? Because I think we're, time wise, we should probably move into it unless you have like a really quick
I do have one really quick one. So I'm taking a course on creating student curriculums right now. And I read this book called Make It Stick by Brown, Rediger, and McDaniel. And it's just a wonderful book and has really changed my whole perception on how to learn. And the basis of the book is basically learning, especially long-term learning, is not actually intuitive. And so they sort of go through and have really great citations on studies on how to make people learn, how to learn better and how to recall information better. So that's high on my list. I don't know if we've ever recommended, I think we might've recommended before, but
Made to Stick by the Heath Brothers is the one that I believe has been recommended, not Make It Stick.
So. Or,
yeah, I think they're very similar titles, but I think you're recommending the Made to Stick is by the Heath Brothers. That's the one that
Make It Stick is by Brown, Rediger, and McDaniel. Okay. And it was recommended by one of my colleagues during this course. So it was really great.
This episode of The Curbsiders is sponsored by ACP's Internal Medicine Meeting 2020, the premier live, clinical, and practice-related education meeting for internists and subspecialists alike, bringing together the best minds and voices of internal medicine from around the world. It is the premier clinical education conference for all internists, where you can stay current while productively earning CME and MOC. Whether you're a primary care internist, hospitalist, office-based internist, or a subspecialist, ACP's Internal Medicine Meeting is a highly efficient way for all internists to keep up to date with the latest medical trends and practice-changing advances in medical knowledge.
Early bird pricing is still available through January 31st, 2020 at annualmeeting.acponline.org. And don't forget to use the code IM20CURB. All right, Chris. Well, let's start off with a case. I'm very disappointed to see that there is not a clever name.
Justin Burke asked us to put one in. I just could not bring myself to make up anything. So,
okay. Well, his name is Cal Esterol, and that's.
Oh man.
Best I can do on short notice, Chris.
All right. So Cal Esterol is a 55-year-old African-American female with hypertension and hyperlipidemia here for an annual exam. Her lipid panel shows the following: a total cholesterol of 230, HDL of 35, LDL of 170, and she is a former smoker having quit 7 months ago. Her blood pressure is 140 over 90 and is on lisinopril, and her ASCVD risk is 25%. So I guess our first question is, we have this new these guidelines since 2013 with this ASCVD risk calculator. Where does this calculator actually come from, and what is the meaning of when we get results from this calculator?
Yeah, so in terms of the cholesterol guidelines, we want to match the intensity of therapy with the absolute risk of the patient. So for primary prevention, we have to start somewhere with some kind of assessment. So we've in the 2018 cholesterol guidelines, we did still bring forward this concept about this 10-year risk assessment using the pooled cohort equation, which was derived from a sort of diverse U.S. Cohorts. It was a sex and race-specific equations first introduced in 2013. It's best calibrated for non-Hispanic whites and blacks living in the U.S., so it may not predict well for other race ethnicities. But importantly, it predicts 10-year risk for both coronary events and for stroke. But the input variables are very similar to what we saw back in the Framingham. It's age, sex, race, total and HDL cholesterol, systolic blood pressure, use of blood pressure medications, smoking and diabetes. And again, that's we'll estimate 10-year risk for the start of the conversation. But as we'll talk about the new updated 2018 guidelines, then allows you to sort of personalize from that by considering other risk-enhancing factors to help guide decisions about statin therapy.
Aaron, I wanted to break in about the, in 2018, we had covered the paper that appeared in the Annals, kind of looking at recalibrating these, kind of updating the data that was, that goes into the pooled cohort equation. They had a revised equation. This was by Yadlowski, and it was Annals Internal Medicine 2018. Is that being used in practice now? Is it, have they updated the pooled cohort equation since 2013 that we're using now, or is it still the same kind of pool of patients?
So it's the same equation that was derived back in 2013. It's very hard in clinical practice to constantly recalibrate with every single different population. So what the 2018 guidelines emphasize, that this is the start of the risk discussion, is this calculation. But we know from a lot of the papers that emerged soon after 2013, that this calculator is imperfect. There's situations where it both overestimates risk in populations with less social deprivation, and then it actually can underestimate risk in certain other populations. And so this can lead to over or under treatment, which is why the 2018 guidelines are more personalized. They include, especially for those, the borderline or intermediate risk group individuals, to consider a lot of clinical factors that you already know about the patient, you know, such as family history, South Asian ancestry, autoimmune disease, HIV disease, a number of lipid and other biomarkers. You know, this information might help strengthen the decision to start a statin or intensify statin, but you can use these other factors to personalize, given the limitations that was brought up after 2013 with this calculator overestimating risk in a lot of individuals.
Yeah.
Now, I have one question. Actually, sir, two questions. But my first question is, I think you said something about intermediate risk, and is this a newer risk category that wasn't in the 2013 guidelines. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the after you calculate the 10-year risk, so first of all, I want to start with the fact who should get a 10-year risk assessment. So this is primary prevention. This is designed to be used for individuals who are 40 to 75 who don't have diabetes, because statins are recommended for patients with diabetes regardless of the 10-year risk score. So patients 40 to 75 without diabetes who have LDLs 70 to 189. Because above 190, severe primary hypercholesterolemia, those individuals are, again, recommended for statins regardless of the 10-year risk score. So these are the people you'd estimate the score. And then you break them into four bins. So individuals who are low risk are less than 5% 10-year risk. Most of the time, lifestyle is enough for those individuals. Individuals with a greater than 20% 10-year risk, this is high risk category, and usually pharmacological therapy is needed with lifestyle therapy. And then you have the two groups in the middle, the borderline, which is 5 to 7.5%, and then the intermediate group, which is 7.5 to 19.9%. So this is the groups in the middle, and above 7.5% 10-year risk is still a statin benefit group where you would consider statin therapy, but the guidelines then said that you can use these risk-enhancing factors to help strengthen the decision to use a statin. And then if risk is uncertain, after you calculate the 10-year risk and after you consider these risk-enhancing factors, if there's still uncertainty about whether to start statins for intermediate or select borderline individuals, you can also measure a coronary artery calcium score to further refine that risk upwards or downwards to guide statin decisions.
Yeah, I think, go on, Paul.
I was just gonna say, I think our natural tendency, you know, we're using these risk estimates to decide sort of where to start medication. I think our tendency is to think of this in terms of medication management. And I know that sort of the cornerstone of therapy is the therapeutic lifestyle change stuff. And I sometimes, certainly with me, it gets short shrift. I'm just wondering if you have sort of a standard spiel, or I mean, obviously you tailor it to the patients, but sort of what general principles do you talk about when you're talking about the lifestyle changes that go along with the medication management?
Oh, absolutely. So this is the foundation for managing cardiovascular risk and blood cholesterol, is the facilitation of a healthy lifestyle, which of course means diet. And this is important across the lifespan, particularly from primordial prevention, trying to prevent risk factors from developing in the first place. So certainly we have the discussion about diet. We are recommending diet rich in fruits and vegetables that's low in saturated fats, low in refined carbohydrates, but relatively rich in the polyunsaturated fats, the good fats, and lean protein, particularly plant-based protein, enriched with nuts, plant phytosterols, high fiber foods. Those can potentially reduce LDL cholesterol by up to 30 to 40 milligrams per deciliter. So although a lot of cholesterol, you know, is genetically determined, diet can really make an impact on lipids. And we should never forget to have, you know, to have this discussion with all patients for primary and secondary prevention.
I just want to plan out where we go next with this, because I think talking about how to actually measure the labs is somewhat interesting, and which labs specifically you get, because there is this kind of mention of some of the, I guess, adjuvant labs. You talked about like risk enhancing factors. Do you think now is a good time to go through that, Chris, or do you want to?
Yeah, I want to talk about risk enhancing factors because I think this is sort of an interesting area. Especially, I think there were some added things, especially in these 2018 guidelines, about especially some woman-specific risk-enhancing factors that were not discussed in previous guidelines. I sort of want to delve into that since those are sort of new.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is a really important thing to personalize because, you know, the factors that are in the pooled cohort equations, you know, are sort of just those basic traditional risk factors. But there's a lot of risk factors we know that are meaningful that are not in that equation. And that way, some patients can have their risk underestimated. So these risk enhancing factors include things like having a family history of premature cardiovascular disease, having primary hypercholesterolemia with an LDL of 160 to 189. Again, above 190, we're already thinking about statins. But if you're on the higher end of the LDL of 160 to 189, statins would be encouraged as well. Metabolic syndrome is really important. Chronic kidney disease, chronic inflammatory conditions like lupus, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, HIV. And then I do a lot of women's health research. I'm really excited the fact that premature menopause and a mention of adverse pregnancy outcomes such as preeclampsia are highlighted as factors that enhance a woman's risk. There's also high-risk race ethnicity, the South Asian ancestry. And then if measured, if someone has persistently elevated triglycerides above 175 non-fasting on at least three occasions, that's a risk enhancer. And if measured, an elevated C-reactive protein above 2, an elevated lipoprotein little a, an elevated ApoB, you know, the guidelines don't say that you have to measure these other factors, but if you have that information available and they're abnormal, that would certainly strengthen your decision to initiate statin therapy.
So I just wanted to follow up on the lab wise there. You said non-fasting triglycerides. So the guideline actually says for most patients, you can check a non-fasting lab test, which I think is a lot more convenient a lot of the times, because a lot of the times I'm getting other labs and patients would like totally starve themselves for like 16 hours and they're on a diuretic and then they're in like kidney injury when they get there. So I like the fact that they said non-fasting labs for a lot of patients. And then I guess my follow-up question would be, how do you decide who is getting ApoB testing or LP little a testing, the high sensitivity CRP as well, like those adjuvant tests?
Yeah, so I think ApoB is very useful. So lipoprotein little a, as you may know, is genetically inherited. So you really only have to kind of measure this sort of once to assess someone's risk. Okay. So I certainly measure lipoprotein little a in individuals with a strong family history. I also, and individuals who have premature coronary disease themselves, because in the future, coming down the pipeline may actually be targeted therapy for those with elevated lipoprotein little a. So we won't know who has elevated until we measure it. And actually, the European guidelines say to measure it once in everybody. But I've been certainly measuring it in people's family history. So ApoB, again, a lot of times LDL that we get with our lipid panel tends to be the Friedewald equation, and it doesn't really work all that well with estimating LDL at sort of these extremes of very low LDL. And so a lot of times patients may actually have increased atherogenic particles that may be under-recognized by measuring LDL. So I think I measure it in people when I, you know, think I'm close to sort of goal and kind of want to assess their total burden of atherosclerotic, atherogenic lipid particles. One can measure a CRP. I have to say I'm more of a coronary calcium person in terms of if risk is uncertain for primary prevention, instead of trying to measure more biomarkers and try to assess risk, I look for disease itself, which is a strategy that was endorsed by the guidelines with a 2A indication. If risk is uncertain, you can measure coronary artery calcium score. As plaque is building in the arteries, a certain percentage of it can become calcified. And so the presence of coronary calcium is a strong marker of total atherosclerotic plaque burden. And so if somebody has disease, it really favors starting a statin therapy. So instead of trying to predict risk, I think a coronary artery calcium score, measures the disease itself, which is why when compared head to head to a lot of these markers and studies such as the multi-ethic study of atherosclerosis, coronary calcium has sort of emerged as the most superior marker for refining risk, both upwards and downwards, than all these other biomarkers. So I kind of go straight to coronary calcium when I'm uncertain, but the guidelines do include these other blood biomarkers.
Can you describe I guess my sort of common question is, how often are you ordering coronary calcium scoring, and what types of uncertainties are your most typical cases where you're ordering them?
Yeah, so the most points that go into the 10-year risk score goes to age. So it's largely an age calculator. So there may be a lot of older adults. So simply, almost all men above the age of 60 and women over the age of 70 are above this 7.5% risk threshold. So certainly when there's some kind of uncertainty about their risk, perhaps their cholesterol is not that high and we think that it's mostly age-driven, you can use it to refine the risk, because if there's a zero calcium score, a calcium score of zero is one of the strongest negative risk factors for subsequent cardiovascular events. Although nothing in life is zero risk, but a coronary calcium score of zero is about a 0.1% per year event rate. So it might take someone whose estimated risk is quite high and shift them the post-test probability downward enough where they might feel comfortable deferring statin therapy. So this is really helpful in patients who may be having reluctance to start a statin when we're trying to guide the decision. The presence of plaque, I would strongly favor that they start a statin. They have disease where maybe if the calcium score is zero, I don't have to push them so hard, that puts them in a lower category. I think it's helpful for people who are experiencing statin-associated muscle symptoms for primary prevention in terms of, how hard do we keep, working on trying to get them on statins, trying different doses, trying different regimens. If their calcium score is zero, this puts them into a much lower risk category where maybe statins could be deferred. So I think any case, especially borderline intermediate risk, where there's uncertainty about risk, whether there's sort of reluctance to start statins, I think seeing is believing. So a lot of my patients who maybe didn't want to start a statin, once they saw pictures of their own arteries, they have disease in their own arteries, it becomes a lot more real. So it's helped at least, with some adherence. And it also may help identify individuals who actually may not benefit as much from statins, because a calcium score of zero may actually de-risk them into a lower risk category where they might not get as much net benefit. So it can be really helpful because it can refine risk both upwards and downwards.
One of the editorials in Jack, they have those great kind of guideline summaries that come out each time they publish a guideline. Dr. Ruben Fire wrote this one for the 2018 guideline. And about CAC scoring, he mentioned that a CAC score of zero, you can often withhold or delay statin treatment unless they're a smoker or they have diabetes, or maybe like a really strong family history where you're still worried anyway. Do you kind of throw in those caveats to a non-zero CAC score, or to a CAC score of zero rather?
Yeah. So first of all, it takes time for plaque to become calcified. So I think a calcium score of zero, in a 69-year-old who's survived, to an older age, perhaps with a calcium score of zero is maybe a lot more reassuring. And younger adults, in a 40-year-old, although their short-term risk may still be low, certainly I would consider, reassessment 5 years because they might not have calcified yet. So in terms of what is the warranty period for a zero calcium score? Well, certainly smokers who those with a family history or these other risk enhancers, you might be more vigilant about screening sooner. And I usually don't get a calcium score in patients with diabetes unless they have such extreme statin reluctance, because usually they're indicated for a statin anyway. So I think you have a little bit less confidence about a zero score in these higher risk groups. But data from NASA's study have suggested that even with diabetes, a calcium score of zero, their event rate is pretty similar to a non-diabetic with a calcium score of zero.
Great. Thank you.
So we've been talking about primary prevention, and of course, it looks like this patient might be a good candidate for statin therapy. I guess my main question is, so if you want to start a patient on statin therapy, could you sort of give us in your own words, sort of your script and how you discuss with a patient that do you think they should start on a statin therapy, especially if they seem like they're sort of on the reluctant side?
Right. So first of all, you know, when considering drug therapy, we want to estimate, maximize the intensity of therapy to one's absolute risk. So I really want to discuss the patient, their net benefit. I mean, I was surprised this young woman has who's only 55 has a 10-year risk score above 20%. Usually the problem with young people is that they have a low short-term risk, but a really high lifetime risk. But in randomized clinical trials, for every 1 millimole per liter, 39 milligrams per deciliter reduction in LDL, the relative risk reduction in cardiovascular events is about 22% and about a 10% reduction in mortality. But higher risk people, it depends on the absolute risk of the patient that higher risk people derive more net benefit. So we really, when I talk to them, I talk about the net benefit. I mean, patients like numbers, but I talk to them about this as being prevention drugs. So the sole purpose of giving this is not so much to make the LDL number, although that's important because I think lower is better for higher risk patients, but mostly it's to reduce cardiovascular risk. So I talk to them about risk reduction. For a patient who's statin reluctant a little bit, that's where, if there is some indecision, that's where I think it's the perfect time to get a coronary artery calcium score, because that can help further refine the risk. Again, if their score is zero, maybe you could defer it for now, the statins, and recheck the score in 5 years. But I have had many patients who, you know, once they got the calcium score and they saw the disease in their artery and they have plaque, they were much more willing to start a preventative therapy. So I think that can be really helpful in guiding the risk discussion. But do you want to involve the patient? So it's a patient-clinician risk discussion. So you want to understand their net benefit from statins based on their absolute risk, talk to them about their own concerns, their preferences, and then talk about potential risks of the therapy, which for statins, they're actually a very safe and well-tolerated medication, but can talk about drug-drug interactions or cost considerations, which again, is not so much an issue with statins because they're cheap and generic. But you really want to have this discussion of the intersection of what the evidence shows, your clinical judgment about the patient in front of you, and the patient's own preferences to come up with a patient-centered approach to prevention.
Erin, I wanted to ask, there's a lot of misinformation about statins. I think we've all seen the nocebo effect where they've heard that they're going to get a myopathy, so then they experience a myopathy when they try statins. And how do you address that when patients come to you and say, Dr. Mikos, I have, I don't want to go on a statin. I heard they cause dementia. I heard that my liver is going to fail. I think I have a friend of a friend who had their muscles all broke down. How do you address that? And how do you talk about, what's the risk of that happening versus how much it might lower their, let's just start with that. What's the risk of that happening?
So this is, quite a challenge. As you mentioned, the nocebo effect, the negative anticipation that believing something's going to harm you, you have more likely to report side effects. And it's a real shame because these widespread claims on the internet about, prevent too many people from taking a very affordable, safe, and potentially life-saving medication. So first of all, the guidelines recommend not using the word intolerance when talking to the patient. So we talk about statin-associated muscle symptoms. And most of the time, You know, these could you be comprehensively assess this, and most patients tolerate a rechallenge. And so really emphasize the net clinical benefit. I certainly talk about the tremendous safety data, you know, the risk of severe muscle injury is, you know, less than 0.1%, and that muscle symptoms are actually very unlikely to be caused by the statins. So if they are, you know, having these, we rechallenge with the same statin at lower doses and to reduce the risk. But I really emphasize, you know, the safety. The risk of serious statin-induced muscle injury is like less than 0.1% for rhabdo. For liver toxicity, it's even lower. It's like 1 in 100,000. Right. And so this is a challenging conversation to have with patients. There's no evidence at all that, you know, statins cause cognitive decline or, you know, cataracts or all of these other things have been really quite ruled out with, because we have a lot of large randomized clinical trials. But trying to buy the patient's trust, understand their concerns. We talk about net benefit. We start low. We go slow. It's about building relationships and trying to build their trust. But it can be really hard to compete against the internet.
Yeah.
So I have two questions. To go back on two things that you said. One was you just said that you may start low and go slow for patients who have concerns. So say according to the guidelines, someone's supposed to be started on a high intensity statin therapy. You would, if they have concerns, you may start them at, you know, a low or moderate dose and then work them up to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so clearly there's recommendations about the intensity of therapy to master the absolute risk of the patient. So there's definitely an intensity that I want to get them on. And so for patients that want to optimize their prevention, I start with the recommended dose, the recommended intensity. But for patients that come with this reluctance and they have us, you know, first of all, I assess, do they really need it? So of course, if they're secondary prevention, they need it. And primary prevention, maybe I'll get the calcium score to see if they really need it. But if they really do have a compelling indication for statin therapy, again, to kind of buy their trust, to kind of dissuade some of these concerns they have, I generally do, if they express concerns, you know, start low, make sure that they tolerate it, you know, so that they can see I'm following them and I'm, you know, listening to them. And then, you know, we monitor their LDL to see what the response was, you know, whether they have the LDL reduction we hope to achieve, and then kind of gradually go from there. And this approach has worked for some patients. I think the muscle symptoms that have been reported is dose related. So I think starting low and getting patients kind of used to this concept, I think can be helpful.
Mentioned the intensity thing. I think just to point out for the audience, it's so for high intensity, 50% reduction in LDL. And for moderate intensity, it's what, 30 to 50%, and low intensity is less than 30%. Am I getting that right?
Right. So the individuals who are recommended for high intensity statins, so we are recommending the intensity to get the achieved LDL percent reduction that we want. So a high intensity statin should reduce LDL by 50%. And that's recommended for secondary prevention for age less than 75. It's recommended for people with LDL above 190 would be on a high intensity statin. Patients with a 10-year risk score more than 20% would be recommended for high-intensity statin. And patients with diabetes who have multiple ASCVD risk factors or other diabetes risk-enhancing factors, those would be recommended for high-intensity statins. Moderate-intensity statins reduce LDL by at least 30%, and that would be your sort of your primary prevention cohort that we would start if they didn't have those other factors.
Before I forget, can we just define primary prevention and secondary prevention? And then, Paul, just since we've said them so many times, just who do you lump into primary prevention? Who do you lump into secondary?
Right. So secondary prevention is someone who has had a clinical event, you know, either a myocardial infarction or acute coronary syndrome, or they've had a coronary stent or a revascularization, or they've had a ischemic stroke or peripheral arterial disease. People with had a clinical event. Where primary prevention is people who have not yet had an event, but we're trying to treat risk factors to prevent that first event. And of course, I'm a big fan of primordial prevention, which should begin, you know, from in utero, which is trying to prevent risk factors from developing in the first place by a healthier lifestyle, because even the presence of, you know, one major risk factor by middle age is associated with sort of a shortened survival. So we all should be focusing on primordial prevention. But I want to talk about that. It's a blurred line, really, between primary and secondary prevention, because there's all these people also with subclinical disease. Yeah. You know, the coronary calcium, it's considered primary prevention, but people with elevated scores, particularly above 300, with coronary calcium scores above 300, they have event rates very similar to a stable secondary prevention population. And so I actually kind of treat them like secondary prevention. And I'll point out that the European guidelines actually have shown imaging findings of sort of significant subclinical disease and coronary stenosis on imaging. They also put them into a higher risk secondary prevention group. So I think it's a spectrum. I mean, atherosclerosis is developing over one's lifetime, and that I think that we need to reduce the LDL burden to kind of slow plaque progression. And actually, I think sometimes we wait too long for treatment, that maintaining optimal lipid levels throughout adulthood can help substantially slow the rate of progression of atherosclerotic plaques.
Paul, you had a question?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess a question I had is I feel like I have a somewhat different conversation with my patients in terms of, like, they seem to be fairly trusting that I'm going to not prescribe the medication that will hurt them. And I feel like I try to sort of go over potential side effects. The question I get asked more than any other is, well, what should my cholesterol be? And this is, you know, regardless of sort of primary prevention land or secondary prevention or sort of this muddy middle ground, how, I guess, specifically in regards to primary prevention, how do you frame that conversation when that question comes up? Because it's less, what is my risk reduction and how, like, I don't seem to have that type of conversation. It's more, okay, doc, I'll take it, but what should my cholesterol be? How do you actually answer that question?
Yeah, so this is challenging because it's really, these are risk-based decisions. You know, we make decisions based on risk and not so much based on numbers. Because, for example, a very high-risk person, you know, with an LDL of 70, you know, that's too high. You know, lower is better. You know, in some of these PCSK9 trials, like Fourier, you know, we're trying to get the median LDL less than 30. So, you know, I think the number really sort of depends on risk, and generally, lower is better, but how aggressive we get there really depends on risk. So when most people are born, you know, let's say have FH, sort of the average LDLs or at birth is around 40 to 60 milligrams per deciliter. And then we do have like a lot of acquired lipids throughout lifetime through sort of poor diet and so forth. So I think for people at lower risk, really trying through primordial prevention and healthier diet to try to lower LDL that way. But certainly as risk goes up, we start adding intensity of treatment, which often means adding pharmacological therapy, statins, and then, of course, in secondary prevention, the highest risk individuals, once they're on a maximal statin, if they still have you know, elevated LDL, we would then add, you know, ezetimibe and then even, you know, PCSK9 inhibitors after that if their LDL is still above 70. So the number really lower generally is better, but how we get there and how aggressive we are, it really is a sort of risk-based conversation.
So my next question would be, so you decide to start a patient on a statin therapy. How often are you following up labs? And then, you know, if they are reaching those goals on those follow-up labs, how often do you get repeat labs after that?
Yes. So, you know, this isn't a fire and forget, even though we're not titrating to a specific number, but you do need to measure follow-up labs to make sure that you have the appropriate reduction in LDL that you're anticipating. So after starting therapy, we want to sort of measure between 4 to 12 weeks, sort of, you know, 1 to 3 months after of starting therapy to see, you know, did you get the achieved LDL that you want. You know, if you used a high intensity statin, did you get that 50% reduction? If you didn't, you know, there's conversations you should have about adherence and so forth. And then importantly, when you start thinking about secondary prevention and when you're talking about thresholds of LDL to add on non-statin therapy, you know, you need to measure LDL so that you see if you're above that threshold, you start intensifying therapy by adding on these other drugs for these secondary prevention. And so every time you make a change, certainly I check again, within 3 months if I've made a change.
So what about our patients who've been stable on the therapy? I get this question from residents all the time. They're like, well, they're stable on their statin therapy for the last like 3 years, been getting their lipids annually and they haven't changed at all. Is that something that people continue to do? Would it be reasonable to check it maybe every 3 years or 5 years, patients who are stable on their therapy?
Again, diet, lifestyle, other things can influence, their lipid levels. You know, if a woman goes through, you know, menopause, her LDL may go up. So especially in high-risk patients, I think we still should continue to check in on them if they're on therapy. Now, in younger individuals who if their LDL, if their cholesterol is well-controlled, you may only check every 4 to 6 years. But certainly once you start therapy, we continue to sort of follow labs at least annually. The guidelines say specifically, you know, you measure that first lipid 4 to 12 weeks after initiation. And then after that, it's sort of every 3 to 13 months, you know, depending on, you know, the individual patient's situation.
Right. I feel to some extent it actually shows that you're taking it seriously. Like it may not actually change what you do clinically, but also it's like when you tell someone to, you should diet and exercise and let's not speak of this again for another year. Like I think if instead you sort of actually demonstrate that you're still following it, it reinforces adherence to some degree too, probably.
Right. I mean, one of the biggest risk factors for subsequent cardiovascular events is non-adherence. And so many patients, you know, stop therapy kind of on their own and they don't tell you. And one of the best ways to sort of see if they're sort of non-adherent is to, of course, to be following those labs and checking in on them. Large observational study from the United Kingdom that came out recently, you know, looked at patients prescribed a statin. And so the highest event rates were among people that were not adherent by looking at prescription refills who were, you know, taking low intensity statins. And the lowest event rates were people that were adherent and taking high intensity statins. So, you want to have the appropriate intensity of treatment, to get LDL lower, you know, you have to be taking the appropriate dose and you have to be adherent to the prescribed medications.
Aaron, we had a question. I believe this might have been from Twitter and also just one of the ones that our team had thought of. And I think you kind of answered this already. You said you like to kind of start low and then follow the numbers. Atorva 80 versus Atorva 40 and I guess rosuvastatin 20 versus 40. Do you start at the kind of the lower dose? Because they're both sort of considered high intensity, right? Like Atorva 40 is kind of high intensity versus Atorva 80.
Right. So again, when I said I start low and go slow, I mean, that was for the statin reluctant person. So
right.
We want to get it on the appropriate intensity. So I don't want to give the impression that I would stop at that based on some arbitrary LDL value. So you want to use the right intensity. That was only that I have my goal in mind. I'm just trying to build a relationship to build up. Again, you can get sort of an additional doubling the statin is associated with every sort of approximate 5 to 6% greater lowering of LDL, although muscle symptoms can be dose related. It depends if they're at the risk of the patient. Certainly if they're in your CCU and had acute coronary syndrome, I kind of start them on a Atorva 80 or sort of from the get-go. But in practice, you can get more LDL reduction with the Atorva 80. You can get about 50 to 60% LDL reduction. And with the Atorva 40, it's about sort of 40 to 52% reduction. So you get a little bit more with the Atorva 80, but you might get more side effects. So I think it depends on the patient. I end up using a lot of combination between, you know, Atorva 40 or with ezetimibe for patients that do have some concerns about muscle symptoms, even if it is a nocebo effect. I I tend to do that. But in the highest risk patients, though, I'll start high intensity therapy right in the sort of the CCU. So because hopefully they'll go home on that therapy and stay adherent to it.
So my next question goes back to what you sort of said a little while back. So you spent all this time getting a patient onto a statin therapy. You built this great relationship and they just can't tolerate the dose that you start them on. Now, is like say they have like maybe elevated CK or they don't have elevated CK and they just have lots of myalgias. You said but you know you would possibly re-challenge the patient with the same medication at a lower dose. Like how much lower dose would you consider switching to something like a pravastatin? And then is there a washout period when you stop the patient on a statin and say, well, let's hold off for like a couple of weeks. Now we'll restart it at a lower dose. What is sort of your way at addressing that?
Yeah, so it's challenging. So, because again, you know, about 10% of patients stop a statin because of subjective complaints. But, you know, most muscle symptoms, you know, don't have an erase creatine kinase. And actually, you know, as you know, in clinical trials, there's really no difference in muscle symptoms in individuals treated or not treated with statin therapy. So a lot of it that when patients are rechallenged, most patients with this history of intolerance in randomized clinical trials, when they're blinded, this intolerance is generally not reproducible. So even though this muscle symptoms are unlikely because of a statin, sometimes I'll start, every other day. I tend to use a lot of rosuvastatin. You could use pravastatin, although that's even weaker. There's more, seems to be more muscle symptoms with your simvastatin and your lovastatin. So there seems to be a little bit less maybe with the pravastatin and rosuvastatin, although all statins can have this. So I'll start like rosuvastatin 5 milligrams, you know, 3 times a week for some of my most challenging patients, along with ezetimibe, just to get them on something. You know, any bit of LDL lowering is better, even though if you won't have the anticipated reduction, you know, any amount of LDL that you can lower is better than none. And then we kind of work from there. And then, of course, it depends on the risk of the patient. You know, once you've really tried everything, and this is really the highest dose you can get them on, if it's secondary prevention and their LDL threshold is still above 70, that's when you can start using PCSK9 inhibitors. Or if they have FH, familial hypercholesterolemia, if their LDL is still above 100, although we currently aren't using those for sort of lower risk primary prevention. And in the future, we might have more options. I'm kind of excited about bempedoic acid. We need our large clinical outcome trials, which is being studied. But this is an oral medication that works in the same pathway of cholesterol synthesis as statins, but it doesn't seem to have the same muscle effects. So this may be an option in the future. The Clear Harmony and Clear Wisdom trials have shown that it reduces LDL, but we have to see if it reduces outcomes. But we might have more options for that. And then and down along the PCSK9 pathway, I'm very also excited to see what happens with inclisiran, which is a small interfering RNA that inhibits PCSK9 enzyme. And that is only dosed twice a year. You know, just one more shot. That's an injection, but only one more time than a flu shot. And that can lower LDL by 60%. We just saw that at the American Heart Association with the Orion 10 study.
Talk about compliance. I mean,
yeah, so talk about compliance. So I think that will be, now we have to have the outcome trials. So Orion 4 is looking for outcomes. So we need to see if it reduces outcomes. Although I'm a big believer in LDL, so I think that it's going to reduce outcomes the lower we get LDL. But I think that will help with our younger people, adherence, and with PCSK9 inhibitors so far, we aren't seeing any of these muscle symptoms. So I think there'll be newer therapies down the line. But right now, I still work with them with statin and ezetimibe, unless they're secondary prevention, and then we can have some additional things to offer.
I wanted to just comment on you mentioned outcomes trials with PCSK9. To my understanding, mortality, not yet convincingly shown to have like a big effect on mortality. Maybe one of the agents had a little bit of it, but not the other. But they did seem to reduce non-fatal MI and non-fatal stroke. And that was in like around the 2-year range. And we don't have really long-term safety data on them yet. But so far, we think they're safe.
Yeah, well, the curves are widening. So we have two very large cardiovascular outcome trials for the PCSK9 inhibitors that are the monoclonal antibodies. That's the four-year trial with evolocumab and the Odyssey outcome trial with alirocumab. And, you know, one was 2.2 years and Odyssey, that was four-year, and Odyssey was 2.8 years. But this is everybody, you know, was on the maximally tolerated statin. They were on aggressive secondary prevention. So this was adding on the background of patients that were already pretty well treated. And both Fourier and Odyssey showed that the PCSK9 inhibitors reduced major adverse cardiovascular events by 15%, which I think is meaningful. It was only like a 2% absolute risk, but this was a short trial. And as you know, plaques, as atherosclerosis is progressing, you know, it takes a little time for these for LDL-directed therapies to work. And if you look at the curves, they're continuing to widen, suggesting with more benefit over time. I am suggesting if they continue longer, you might actually see greater benefit. So in Odyssey, which was higher risk patients with acute coronary syndrome, there was a significant mortality reduction in terms of a, you know, that by also a 15% with by the p-value, but because of the pre-specified hierarchical testing, it wasn't considered a significant event because it's they have to go down, you know, with multiple outcomes, and so by the time they reach mortality, even though the p-value was certainly less than 0.05, it wasn't considered significant by that strategy. But I'm really encouraged by the safety was very good. I mean, we got to very low LDL levels.
Incredible. Like incredibly. In the 20s, right? Like
right. I mean, in Fourier, the median LDL was less than a 30, and there has been no signal for harm. Like there has been no increased hemorrhagic stroke risk with very low LDL. You know, we don't see the signal for diabetes that had been raised with statin, higher dose statins. We don't see, you know, any of the muscle symptoms. I mean, the safety data, you know, granted, they were under 3 years, but the safety data was very reassuring, particularly for hemorrhagic stroke. And I think we need to sort of unlearn the concern for a very low LDL. It just seems that there is no floor, that lower is better, and just these high-risk patients to help prevent further plaque progression.
So I think we might have to, because of time, move on to secondary prevention. I do want to touch on three medications that I think in terms of primary prevention that I get asked often about. So the three are aspirin for primary prevention, fibrates for primary prevention, especially with high triglycerides, when to start those, and a new kid on the block, icosapent ethyl. Do you think you could speak to any of those?
Yeah. So, you know, in aspirin, I, you know, I was one of the co-authors for the 2019 primary prevention guidelines. So, you know, we ended up sort of downgrading our recommendation for aspirin based on to a 2B indication. It previously was a class one indication for individuals with 10-year risk scores above 10%. But, you know, for aspirin, you know, risk generally tracks, ASCVD risk tracks with bleeding risk. And we really couldn't find any 10-year cut point where the benefits of aspirin outweighed the risk of bleeding. You know, the absolute benefits of avoiding serious vascular events, you know, in these trials were largely counterbalanced by the increased risk of bleeding, or some of the trials didn't show any benefit. So we gave it a 2B indication. That low-dose aspirin might be considered for the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease only among select adults aged 40 to 70 who have higher cardiovascular risk but not at risk for bleeding. And note that when we say higher risk, we didn't include a 10-year cut point. We recommended the totality of evidence, you know, based on family history. Are they current smokers? Do they have subclinical disease by elevated calcium scores? But we didn't have it based on a 10-year risk a cut point. And so that essentially means that for most individuals, no, don't use aspirin routinely for primary prevention. For some individuals, yes. And we gave a class three recommendation of aspirin should not be used routinely in for primary prevention adults over the age of 70 because of the harm shown in the Esprit trial, or for adults at any age who are at increased risk for bleeding. In terms of triglycerides, so in patients with significant elevated triglycerides, you know, even above 500, we still recommend statins first line because we're trying to prevent events which are plaque driven. So statins are still the first line for ASCVD risk reduction even though they only modestly reduce triglycerides. And this is, of course, you first address all the reversible factors. So a lot of hypertriglyceridemia is due to lifestyle, obesity, metabolic syndrome, poorly controlled diabetes. And you look at medications, you know, estrogens and other therapies. So try to look for reversible factors. But if after you've addressed reversible factors, if their triglycerides are above 500, you know, we would initiate statins. And then if they remain above 500, particularly if they're very high, above 1,000, and you're worried about pancreatitis, this is where it's appropriate to initiate fibrate therapy. Icosapent ethyl from the REDUCE-IT trial. So that was largely a secondary prevention. So everybody was already on statins. That was important. REDUCE-IT enrolled adults who either had established cardiovascular disease, or they didn't. For the primary prevention group was individuals who had diabetes with at least one other risk factor, who were well controlled LDL and a statin and had triglycerides between 135 and 500. And icosapent ethyl, you know, dramatically reduced major cardiovascular events by 25%. And what's really interesting is that it really had this benefit regardless of one's baseline or achieved triglyceride levels. It didn't seem to correlate with triglyceride levels in that I think the mechanisms of benefit are beyond our triglyceride lowering effects with this high dose EPA compound that's 4 grams a day of purified EPA. So likely anti-thrombotic, anti-inflammatory benefits, I think, weigh in, and that maybe triglycerides are a marker of selecting a higher risk person, but not really the target of the therapy. But I just want to point out that I would not extrapolate the very exciting results from REDUCE-IT about icosapent ethyl to the over-the-counter dietary fish oil supplements, because that is not the same thing. Those things are a mixed bag of DHA, EPA. They have saturated fats have been found in these, oxidized fats. So that should not be applied to those over the dietary supplements.
Have you been routinely using icosapent ethyl in your patients?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been using it a lot, but, you know, in high-risk patients, sometimes it's like, what do you, you know, add next? Because I definitely, in high-risk patients, try to get the LDL as low as possible. So, you know, when you're intensifying along the LDL lowering pathway, but, you know, many of my patients have cardiometabolic disease and diabetes and have elevated triglycerides. And so, you know, I think the findings from that trial were really quite compelling. I was sort of prescribing it sort of off-label, and you may have heard that I think the FDA voted kind of unanimously 16-0 that to consider the new indication for this for cardiovascular risk reductions not just a triglyceride treatment medication, but for major cardiovascular risk reduction. So a challenge has even been after this trial, still getting pre-auth approval. I still run into issues with insurance companies, but I'm hoping with this new, with approval from the FDA, that it'll be a little bit easier in the future.
And I think they still have to take it's 4 grams, like the same as, it's 4 grams a day, which which is a lot. I think it's relatively expensive, like $200 to $300 a month. The last I looked it up, and it's the pill burden becomes a thing, I believe. So for everybody, but.
Well, again, I don't apply it to everybody. The people in REDUCE-IT were secondary prevention,
right,
or high-risk diabetics with multiple risk factors. That's who's in there. I'm very interested in seeing trials in lower-risk primary prevention, but those are the people in there. But if you were to try to get 4 grams of EPA by dietary supplements, I don't recommend it, but if you're going to try to do that, that's probably like 25 pills to try to get to that amount of EPA.
Right.
Relatively, related to that. So, when you're trying to target which therapies, you know, I look at sort of their broad lipid profile, but I think this is a really, good option. I mean, 25%, it was really quite meaningful reduction in risk.
So we sort of slid a little bit into secondary prevention, right? I just want to clarify just one thing in terms of secondary prevention, and I think it's a big point that was different with the 2018 guidelines is in the secondary prevention, you know, one big fork is this very high risk group versus stable ASV group. And if you could sort of explain sort of the main difference, because I think there's a lot of confusion among that. by some of my residents and my other learners.
Yeah, so exactly. So just like we talked about primary prevention, how intense we do the therapy is based on the absolute risk of the patient. It's the same concept in secondary prevention, that there's a big difference between someone who's in your CCU who just had an acute coronary syndrome versus someone who maybe got a stent 10 years ago with for stable angina, and so they're sort of at lower risk. And so when we look at trials like Improve It, that was acute coronary syndrome patients, Odyssey outcomes. You know, the guidelines give a much stronger recommendation for individuals who are at very high risk. And so among the secondary prevention cohort, those who have very high risk are those who've had a recent coronary syndrome within the past 12 months, you know, have had multiple MIs, ischemic stroke, you know, symptomatic peripheral arterial disease with other risk conditions such as being older, having FH or diabetes and CKD and smoking. And so if you have, one of these major events or multiple high-risk conditions, we want to be even more, aggressive with their therapy. So everybody for secondary prevention under the age of 75 is recommended for a high-intensity statin. Again, the goal is to reduce LDL by 50%. And then the guidelines now have added back thresholds. Now, this is not targets. These are thresholds because just like in the four-year trial and the Odyssey outcomes trial, this to get enrolled in the trial, you had to have an LDL above 70 to be enrolled in the trial. So these are thresholds to add on non-statin therapy, but they're not a target. We're not treating the targets. So for the more stable, not at very high risk secondary prevention, it's only a 2B indication to add ezetimibe if the LDL threshold is still above 70. We're in a very high risk patient. It's a little bit stronger, should be considered, is reasonable to start ezetimibe on top of a maximal statin if the LDL is above 70, to add ezetimibe as a 2A indication. And then for this very high risk group, if you're on a maximal statin and you're on ezetimibe and your LDL is still above 70, that's where the PCSK9 inhibitor comes in with a 2A indication, is in these very high-risk groups. And this delineation is somewhat due to cost. The U.S. guidelines as opposed to the European guidelines did take cost consideration in their recommendation, and that's why they sort of reserve the PCSK9 for the very highest risk group.
And then you pray it gets approved by insurance.
Right.
How do you guys get around insurance approvals? Do you have like some nurses who are really good at like getting these pushed through in terms of prior auths, or is there a certain way? I think that the ACC actually has like almost like a insurance tool to help people get these approved. Do you guys use any of those types of tools?
Yeah, so I think it's gotten a lot easier, a little bit easier over time as the process gets really streamlined. So we do have one kind of lipid clinic that where we have patient navigators and pharmacists that can really people that can help us. We have a lipid nurse practitioner that's gotten really good at filling out the paperwork. It's kind of knowing what we need in terms of documentation about statin intolerance and cardiovascular risk and filling this out. So having kind of training kind of one group of people who can do this really well, I think can really help navigate the system. So knowing the FDA approved indications, and then prescribing and reinforcing based on these indications. And navigators that we sort of call them, they can become really familiar with these forms, and we have just a lot more success. And you can really leverage the electronic medical record to facilitate this process. It's also really helpful as a team-based approach to teach patients how to take the medication, what to expect, and again reinforce adherence to their other medications. So I think it's getting easier, or maybe we're just getting better at knowing what paperwork to fill out. But it's still a challenge for other types of medicines. I still have trouble sometimes with icosapent ethyl or some of the new SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 receptor agonists. The pre-auths can be quite painful.
Yeah.
I think we're going to ask for some take-home points. Are you guys good with that? Any other questions?
Yeah, I think we have to go to take-home points, and this conversation can spill over to Twitter, or we can invite Aaron back for a round two, or maybe just let her answer listener questions or something like that. That's an episode I do want to pilot at some point this year.
Well, great. Well, you know, again, I think I've sort of summarized some of my main points, but that lifestyle is still the foundation for prevention. We still, the most important way to prevent cardiovascular disease is through a healthy lifestyle throughout one's lifetime. And then keep in mind that one's, you know, risk of atherosclerotic plaque, total plaque burden is really not only the magnitude of LDL elevation, but the duration of exposure. So again, emphasizing sort of primordial prevention and treating earlier. But in terms of pharmacological therapy, it's all sort of risk-based decisions. And so I'd focus more on that than treating to numbers or treating to targets, that making sure that higher risk people get on the most appropriate therapy. And we talked about secondary prevention, maximal tensive statins, and then adding on ezetimibe and PCSK9 for the highest risk individuals. And then in primary prevention, you know, when there's uncertainty about risk, you know, considering all those risk enhancers and then coronary artery calcium scores can be helpful to guide the conversation for shared decision making, to define risk upwards or downwards to make decisions. But I would really recommend a sort of a team-based approach with care, involved dietitians, nutritionists, exercise physiologists, nurse educators, and really come up with a patient-centered approach and engaging the patient, because adherence is one of the biggest predictors of outcomes. And so we need to get the patients on board and be partners in their own health for cardiovascular disease prevention.
All right. I have not been checking LP little a. I definitely want to, that's something I might have to work into my, like, you know, repertoire here, because I like the point. I hadn't heard the point that it's like something you could just check once. And then, you know, if it's, it kind of helps risk stratify. I like that a lot.
Well, it's highly heritable, and it's not really influenced as much by diet or other medications, unfortunately. People didn't check it in the past because we didn't really have a lot of therapy to lower it. Statins don't really lower LDL, that lipoprotein little A, that much, although they do lower risk. So I measure it, because if they have high lipoprotein little A, I put them on statins not to lower the lipoprotein little A, but to prevent plaque progression and lower risk. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we don't really use niacin. Niacin can lower modestly lipoprotein little A, but that also has other side effects. If they're high risk, PCSK9 inhibitors can lower lipoprotein little A by about 20%. So that's an option for those that are candidates. But the reason partly to measure this now, as you may know, there's a new ASO drug, antisense oligonucleotide, which can dramatically lower lipoprotein little A by 90%. Oh. I mean, we have no other drug that can do that. So that's very exciting. And in phase 2 trials, it seems to be safe. And it seems to lower lipoprotein little A. But like with all these new things that are in the pipeline, we need the outcome trial. We need to show that safe once we apply it to thousands of people, and whether, most importantly, whether it reduces major adverse cardiovascular events.
Yeah.
So I'm excited in the future. We may have bempedoic acid. We may have inclisiran. There's a bunch of triglyceride targeted therapies with therapies against ApoC3, you know, and then we have these ASO drugs against for lipoprotein little A. So it's an exciting time to be in lipids. We're going to have a lot more options than statins, hopefully, in the future, if these are shown to be safe and efficacious.
Very cool.
I was so happy to have one class of medication to worry about. This all sounds very anxiety provoking.
And once again, just check out Dr. Mikos' paper in New England Journal on lipid management. It's fantastic.
Link it in the show notes.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
It was wonderful.
This was really awesome. Great.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. Blessed silence. Get your show notes at curbsiders.com/podcast and sign up for our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledge food to get our weekly show notes in your inbox.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, or contact us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producers for this episode, Dr. Jasneet Devgan, Beth Garbatelli, Dr. Justin Burke, and Dr. Kate Grant. And also thanks to our social media team, Anna R. Abrams on Twitter, Beth Garbatelli on Instagram, and Chris the Chew Man Chew, which is me, on Facebook. Until next time, I've been Chris the Chew Man Chew.
Missing Stuart Kent Brigham tonight, but he composed this wonderful theme music that you hear playing over top of my voice. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I've been Beth Garbatelli.
That's the good stuff. And I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.